CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. How are you, Ramon?
I'm well. Are we going to make South Africa great again after this podcast?
We are certainly trying.
Actually, our joke, South Africa was never great. Don't kid ourselves.
Yeah, now you're going to get told that you long for the apartheid days.
Oh, God.
Yeah, now you've done a die in Colobana.
South Africa was never great. It was great in, like, 1302, I think. After that, it's all downhill.
1302?
Yeah, when no one was here, I think.
The Khoisan.
Yes.
You know, enjoying their lives. And then the Zulu came and just destroyed everything.
Oh, wow. Now, you think I'd get in trouble for saying that, and you?
Right. So, after the white folk give back the land, the Zulu people can give back the land too. We have a show today that is just yours truly and Ramon. We haven't done a solo for a bit of time, and we thought it was now or never.
There were just too many interesting people to talk to. But I think the solo shows are quite nice just to reorientate our thoughts about things that are happening at the moment. And excuse me. And then, yeah. So let's get straight into it. So as we speak, Wits is burning down. Well, not burning down. Bramfontein is...
Well, no, fire was taken quite seriously by many people, and even the Wokites,
the
Wokity Brigade, even they got a bit upset about that whole burning the library at KZN. So they obviously have gathered together and decided, look, guys, don't burn shit, rather throw rocks at shit. That's much better.
Okay, well, let's be careful. It's some people. We don't know if they actually are part of... Fees Must Fall or not. I actually read an article in the Daily Pox. I mean, they're actually called the Daily Vox, but I call them the Daily Pox.
That's great. That's going to stick.
Because the Daily Pox made a point that what is this protest actually about? And lo and behold, Fees Must Fall is not actually about fees. So there's a bit of a PR problem there. It's about ending rape on campuses. It's about free education. It's about decolonizing education. And I can't remember the fourth one. Anyway, it doesn't really matter, I suppose. But none of this has to do with fees. Because, I mean, if it's free education, it's free education. There's no fees involved.
Yeah. So, well, we know that, for example, last year, one of the main issues raised by the Fees Must Fall people was the insourcing of workers.
Right.
They... which I have long held the belief, and if you've listened to previous shows, essentially that's got to do with control at the universities through political parties and unions. But eventually they actually got Wits to agree to insourcing. They have managed to get the same at some other universities. At Wits, they agreed to 100 million rands worth of insourcing over and above their actual budget. And so that's 100 million rand that now goes to something that doesn't need to and diverts fees away from other things, such as educating students or providing funding.
Right. The outsourcing thing is a bit odd to me. I don't see what workers' rights have to do with fees at the end of the day. But then again, I mean, I don't think this is about fees at all. I think it's quite clear it's an ideology of sorts. And the question is, where are they learning about this ideology? What is Wits teaching these people? Or what is UCT teaching these people?
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't just have these ideas coming from nowhere. They are from somewhere. And why do a lot of different type of people believe in the same ideas? It is a bit strange.
Well, I think we need to get down to, you know, that they should really be honest. We've got a situation whereby fees were 0% last year, the increase to this year, the 2016 fees. The minister then comes out, and really just takes no responsibility. Goes, as a communist, I believe in the free market. So the universities should be allowed to increase their fees, whatever they want. Of course, he did say up to 8%. So there was a cap. But he's not going to tell anyone what to do, knowing that whether the university puts it up 0.5% or all the 8%, and there is then violence, he can turn around and go, well, I never increased it. You'd made that decision. So he sends it back to the universities. We haven't yet had a decision from any of the universities about what they're doing.
No, exactly. And so why are people rioting already?
Yeah. So that's part of the problem. But, you know, a lot of it I've looked into. I'm quite involved at WITS from an alumnus side of things, and I've looked at the numbers. They've got over 20,000 people. They're 33,000 students, roughly, at WITS. 20,700 of those received financial aid, scholarships or bursaries in 2015.
Is that the NAFSIS?
That's through NAFSIS and other sources.
Okay. So two-thirds don't actually pay anything?
Essentially a billion rands worth of funding already that sure. goes towards those students. The argument about the missing middle has largely disappeared because they have looked at the people that get sort of cut out. So the missing middle, for those of you who don't know, is you can only apply for the sort of funding if you're poor enough. It's the same as you can only apply for an RDP house if you're poor enough.
Yeah, there's a means test of sorts, I think.
But unfortunately, you might just miss that and actually still not be able to afford your fees. And I think important point to be made, because I'm sure you've had a fair amount of abuse on social media. Let's not call it abuse. Let's just call it criticism, because I really don't feel abused. But a lot of what I've received is, oh, no, you know, people are being left behind, and reality is this isn't happening anymore. These people are being identified. Obviously, anyone who is passing their degree and cannot afford to pay should not be excluded from a university. That is unacceptable, especially in our country. That's my view, at least.
No, I agree. I think those that actually are academically gifted should pay as little as possible, though I don't think being academically gifted gives one an entitlement not to pay something.
So what's happening now is actually that, for example, with what Blade announced, because government will cover those who can't afford it. So Fort Hare, for example, can turn around and go, everyone gets 0% next year, because government is covering, their students are in such a position that they can't afford it, and so pretty much all their students get a zero rating. In terms of fee increases. Somewhere like WITS or UCT doesn't have the same situation, but those who are going to get hit with the 8% are people that can afford it.
Well, and it's the minority
of
students.
And I think most people, we can make good arguments against this, but I think most people feel that it's okay and fair. I don't agree with that, but that it's fair that sort of rich people pay and then other people don't. That's our social sort of system.
Sure.
And fine, it's no issue. One of the problems that I've been told from a couple of insiders at WITS is that students simply don't want a loan. They want a handout. So
yes,
they want to be told, you can come here, you can study your 4 years, and when you are done and you then go on to work for a bank or work for an accounting firm or wherever you end up working, you know, gender studies is a huge thing. There's a gender studies agency on every corner, as we know. They pay very well as well. Once they've done their 4-year degree, they don't want to pay it back.
Right. Well, I think 70% of NAFSA's
Students don't pay back, and government doesn't chase them.
Sure.
So that's where we are. We're at the point where I think the argument is not about I can't afford to go. The argument is I can afford to go, or I'm being given the opportunity to go, but I never want to pay for it. I want free education completely.
Sure. And I mean, yes, and then that's when I become a bit unsympathetic, because there's no right in law for that to happen. People still quote the Freedom Charter as some sort of legal document. And I'm going to quote my favorite intellectual with his argument is like, people, it's 2016. Why are you thinking these things?
I was going to say your favorite intellectual, Thomas Sowell, but no, of course, you've quoted a man far greater in mind.
Far greater.
Far greater.
Peace be upon him.
Peace be upon him. It's 2016, people. What a great argument. World debater. That's the level we've reached. It's just not a viable situation. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. I saw Sinclair tweeting quite a bit about this.
Right.
And it doesn't exist. Someone's got to pay. There's always going to be payment.
But what I'm struggling to understand is that The crux of the problem is actually the state, as always. So why are they going after the proxies, which is the universities in this case? And why are people protesting about something that cannot actually happen, right? Yeah.
So
if violence doesn't make the state say, okay, cool, we'll give you what you want, it doesn't work that way. There are processes to follow and lobbying to do and things like that. And maybe in 5 years, we're in a position to hand out tertiary education for free. And then there are a lot of issues with that as well. I mean, I'm not in favor of free education.
So, I mean, I don't think that that's a viable thing. You know, everyone goes, the government can afford it. Well, currently the government on average funds most universities about 12% of their entire income. So we're talking about 80 to 90% of what any university gets in comes from either what they get from students who can afford it, what they get from partnerships that they have with the private sector, what they get from research, all these types of areas. It's not coming from directly government going, here's money for students to study. So I don't think that's necessarily a viable argument.
Yeah, and I mean, and the government is obviously not innocent in this regard. The flagrant corruption and just wastage is massive.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I lack sympathy for like all three entities.
So
in this regard, the government, the students, and the universities themselves, because I don't think the quality of the education is really merited. Some of them are really good, but most, I mean, the BA and the BCom students subsidize like everyone else. I mean, let's agree to that, because a lot of people...
I don't have the statistics, but I would guess that that's probably correct just based on numbers.
Right. And these people learn about this decolonization, I don't know, theory at WITS or at UCT or at wherever.
I don't know if those are part of the course curriculum yet. I'm sure they will be shortly. I think that's, for me, where the criticism to management goes. I said to the other members that sit on the convocation with me, who are all very senior academics and business executives, I said that there is an element of us, both the convocation, the council, etc., just needing to actually take a position that is based in a little bit of maturity. Because for me, I feel like we... in some part, dealing with petulant children who you know, there was that one, was it a Facebook message about, you will listen and you will not interrupt us, and if you're white, you will just listen, and if you're management, you will just listen. And I think that instead of management capitulating over and over again, it's basically what you're doing is you have a child throwing a tantrum in the middle of a shopping center, and the way you're dealing with that is trying to placate the child.
Right.
Instead of walking away and saying, this is not how you behave, and when you are prepared to behave in a decent fashion, we can have a discussion.
Well, another issue is that there are actually channels, you know, for this. There are grievances can be transmitted.
Oh,
well. Through various processes. I mean, Jonathan Janssen, okay, I don't know if he's there anymore, at University of Free State, he has an open door policy, for example. You can meet him any afternoon between 4 and 6, I believe it was.
Well, Adam Habib, I'm not a fan at all, but Adam Habib has been very open to students. I think a bit too much, actually, in terms of taking on their ideas and just running with them. But he really has been on the student side, so to speak. I tell you, from sitting on a management body or a body that gives sort of advice to the university, that most people don't come from my perspective. They're not sitting there going, we disagree with the students. Most people have huge sympathy for the students. Most people are on the student side. The problem is that, and once again, it's nuanced, because perhaps there are some students who really feel that there's an injustice happening, and that even if it's just down to a few hundred students being left behind each year, which I don't have the data yet, I'm trying to get it, but I tend to feel that that is where we're at. Even if it's just those few hundred being left behind every year, it's a huge injustice. But then there are other students who just want to throw stones. I had this on Twitter today. I had people, after I made the comment, they got very upset. Of all the things I said, protesters, or some protesters, got very upset that the insinuation was made that because we're close to exams, of course, this would be the time that you choose to shut down the university.
Yes.
And And they're very upset about that, but then some saying, well, I'm going to pass and throw stones, or I did throw stones and will pass. So I think there are some people who just like being part of the chaos.
I agree with that. I mean, there was a great video on ENCA last night, actually, Jeremy Max.
I haven't seen it. Jeremy Max, the student is nuts.
But I think he was on something or other. He was take off his shirt and he was fidgeting and he wouldn't actually, his speech was slurred. So, I mean, are these people actually taking some sort of stimulant or some sort of drug beforehand?
Well, the other point that's being made is that some of the protesters aren't even students. That
Max Price
we
made
have
that point,
we
yeah.
have political parties getting involved, or just you know people who want to kind of cause trouble. I know the ANC has said this often in you know in service delivery protests. They claim that a service delivery protest might be legitimate, but then there are you know they love saying the third force.
There are elements,
but there are elements. Yeah. There are criminal elements, and I think that there is some. There may be some logic to that happening. In other words, you have a chaotic situation. You can see this all around the world when riots develop, for example. So there's a very real situation where there's chaos for some reason.
Well, let's call it protest develop, yeah, not riots. It becomes a riot.
Yeah, a protest, or there's just chaos because of whatever. It can be a bad weather. It can be, you know, a power failure.
Black Friday.
Sure. it can be what happened with the cops, they shot an innocent kid this last week in the States, yeah. And then that leads to protests, which then became riots. And in those riots, people then loot stores, for example. That not to say that all the protesters are criminals, but I think it's a good opportunity to kind of do that if that's your inclination.
It certainly is. I mean, the problem here for me is that I'm not here to give solutions. I don't think there is any due to the current structure of the problem. You got a country that's running out of money. You got cash-strapped people, you have cash-strapped universities, and you have an expectation, an ideological expectation of like free education. So like it's a complete fuck-up, excuse my language, but it's a complete fuck-up. And something has to give, and I'm afraid that might just be the universities. I'm afraid they might have to retrench, or they might have to really downsize. And then I think we far worse off, because the best and brightest won't want to stay here.
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes back to what you said about quality. The truth is that our universities do produce quite good quality currently.
Yes.
Especially actually in our STEM subjects, for example.
Absolutely.
We are quite respected worldwide. We're actually also quite respected in the business field, for example. I mean, a lot of my stuff comes from WITS, but I know we're ranked somewhere around 30th in the world. WITS business graduates are ranked somewhere about 30th in the world for their potential to lead global companies and become CEOs and things like that. And, you know, that's amongst quite a good group of other universities.
Yes.
And that'll go away. I agree with you. We already know from friends that we've had discussions with who are involved in the universities that downsizing is happening and that people are very scared of losing their jobs. If you're a protester and you're very excited about that, you shouldn't be, because ultimately those people have skills which they would like to impart on you, and now they're not going to be able to. But what do you think about the ethics of this actually being a very small problem? Because it's dominating headlines at the moment. It's not just, you know, Twitter, and which isn't, we've said repeatedly, isn't real life.
Yeah.
It is headline news. And we've got 1 million people who enter matric. If I'm not mistaken, 300,000 or 400,000 who actually exit matric.
Well, you mean enter grade one?
Sorry.
1 million enter grade one.
1 million enter grade one.
And I think it was 300,000+.
Yeah, the Institute of Race Relations has this data, but I'm sure other people have the data too. But it's somewhere in the 300,000 mark that actually leave matric.
Yes.
And in terms of the bunch that leave matric with university exemption,
it's 20,000-30,000.
No, it is more than that. It's over the 100,000 mark.
Oh, okay.
It is over the 100,000 mark, but. So it's a very small group of people. So what we're trying to do here is say, okay, you know, even if tomorrow you could go to any university you wanted for absolutely nothing, all you had to do was apply.
Yeah.
The entrance criteria would still stand, unless you've decolonized and decided, you know, that the gallbladder isn't really where the gallbladder is, because that's a Eurocentric idea. So Okay, that's probably not steel manning the argument very well.
It's quite funny, though. Just to be very flippant, decolonization looks a lot like Marxism to me.
That's because...
Another great European import. What are you decolonizing?
It has its roots in Marxism. This concept of we're worrying about a small group.
I think it's 3% of the whole population of students, right?
Of the entire country. So 97% of people this doesn't really affect.
Not for the moment.
Yeah. I don't understand why we don't see this, for example, not a fees must fall, but an education. And can we really lose the fall word? I mean, we'll get onto other fall things later, but this things must not fall. That is destruction. Can you stop tearing things down? Not everything needs to be torn down. Maybe the state, we can have that discussion. The state must fall. Absolutely. Might be the only thing. We really should be trying to build things up. Why are we not having this furor over education must improve? Basic education must improve. That million people that enter school should finish school.
Well, or most of them, yes.
Or we would like them to because we...
Because I think that's a lot harder work. I do think that people really get a sense of identity once they become students. I really do think that. And they are in a group of people, should groups exist, of course. They're in a group of people that sort of have the same issues at that time. But as we said before, the issue is how expensive the fees are, and it only affects maybe 10% of all students at WITS, not 80% of them, because some are funded. It's a really complicated situation. I think it's a bit of that, you know, you get that madness of crowds scenario.
Yeah.
Where someone is a firebrand and has a cause, and you're just like, you know what, fuck it. My life's a bit boring. Let's go join a cause, and we can change the way things are. And I think
have nothing to lose.
It's a bit of naivety. It's a bit of everything. But unfortunately, its impact is disastrous on a lot of, on other students. That's the big problem.
And
on the greater, on society in general, because if your universities fall, I mean, where do the thought leaders, in the original sense, not the Mail and Guardian sense, where do the thought leaders, where are the new engineers, where are the new entrepreneurs coming from?
Yeah.
If they're not coming from our universities, I don't know. Yeah.
So I think, you know, and we have made the point repeatedly, you don't need a degree to succeed in life.
No.
And actually, just on the matric stuff, the data also shows that the greatest decider of whether you will get a job or not is whether you have a matric in this country.
Indeed.
You still might battle to get a job because employment is hard to come by, but your chances are much, much greater if you have a matric as against if you dropped out of school. But I mean, you've raised a lot of points there. What about the students who actually want to study? I've been trying to push this quite hard, which is that I really believe that the majority of students, we're seeing maybe even a few thousand. I don't even think it is that many. It's probably a couple of hundred. Who are very loud, very aggressive, are able to sort of scream at cameras and say, you know, all the buzzwords. But essentially, we have thousands. So remember, I'll use WITS as an example, but UCT is similar size. UKZN, Free State will all be large universities. Fortier, I think, as well. There are 33,000 at WITS, and we're seeing a few hundred making a noise.
And how many are actually throwing stones at the police? Yesterday, there was a video. How many? There were like 20?
Yeah.
30 people throwing stones.
And even though the Great Hall stoning, which broke all that glass, I saw a picture which showed about three or four guys.
Exactly.
Throwing. I think that the majority, and this is what bugs me about all these narratives, is that you don't hear the sort of silent majority.
Yes.
Who I truly believe want to just carry on and get on with it. I mean, if you currently are a student at WITS, your year is paid for. Okay. The way it will work is if you are, and this is most universities, if you are not paid, if you haven't paid, you will still carry on, most universities will even allow you to write your exams. They just won't release your results at the end of the year. So that's where your problem will come in December, January. Your problem isn't right now.
But even then, Jonathan, I mean, if some students have to find their voice, I think the threats of violence, intimidation is really, really high.
Well, that's some of the feedback I got.
I think you are dealing with people who actually want to hurt others. I saw a good friend, Mr. Kwabe, at UCT yesterday. Mm-hmm. He was a shambok in a lecture hall, and he didn't hit someone, but he acted like he wanted to, because someone didn't follow his orders, like a little fascist that we said he was.
Where is the law as well? I mean, we have a law against that now.
Yes, it's common assault, I believe.
But we have a law against carrying traditional weapons, as an example. Yes. We can debate whether that law is fair or not and where it came from, because I think it was very Americana-related.
Yes.
So there are problems with it. But there's a law. What he's doing is illegal. I don't think a shambok belongs on a university campus, just like I don't think a gun or a knife belongs on a university campus.
No.
Why is it so hard to just kind of see the guy, okay, he's throwing the stone, all right, arrest him? Like, why is it such a complex thing?
Our police are up to shit as well. The police aren't angels in this either.
They're not angels, number one. And number two is, I think they're petrified to deal with groups now.
I don't think they're petrified. I think they're just not trained properly.
We
spoke to someone who's in Parliament dealing with police issues, and like in terms of morale and training and all that, like it's really awful. It's really awful. We haven't had a police commissioner, you know, she's been suspended. Ever since Americana, and even before then, the police brutality is a big issue in this country. So basically all you're seeing in if you look at totality is like state policy that's absolute failure. And that is running through the universities, it's running through expectations of people, it's a bad police force, it's a lack of money in the economy, and there's only one culprit.
You say the state.
The ANC voter.
Yeah. Well, can't disagree with that.
I had a good argument with someone on yesterday about the ANC voter is a great argument against democracy. Because on any measurable scale, the ANC have been absolutely awful this past, well, since Zuma came in, to be fair. In terms of economic freedom, in terms of the economy, in terms of our international view, in terms of every single aspect of like state measurement indices, ANC has been awful, yet they still managed to win overwhelmingly in elections.
Listen to a podcast about
amazing.
Let's get on to voters. just on a side, it just came to me because it might have been the Fifth Column. Relatively good podcast. I quite enjoy it. Sometimes I disagree with their stuff, but that's okay too. And they were saying, I don't know if it was theirs, but they were the argument was, should everyone be allowed to vote, essentially. And there were, so one thing that they said was, maybe there should be like a criteria that everyone can like comply with, but if you want to vote. But for example, they said economics 101, might be something you want every voter to have.
It might be Free Thoughts Radio. They had a guy who wrote a book called Against Democracy.
Yeah,
it's called Against Democracy. It says the biggest danger to individual, freedom and ability is actually the voter, because in studies that they've done in the US, at least, the average voter is just so ignorant of anything that is policy related.
Yeah,
they have no idea.
Yeah, sorry, just to correct, that podcast is Free Thoughts from libertarianism.org.
Yeah.
It's actually quite an interesting, if you're interested in libertarian concepts, then It's a good.
But especially that one, because he goes through voting patterns of people and why people vote the way they do. And interestingly, people vote on the majority of voters actually vote altruistically. They think, what is the best for our society in general?
Hmm.
Yet when you actually ask them, if you ask a voter how other voters vote, they said no, they just vote for their self-interest.
Hmm.
But actually all of them vote altruistically. Interestingly enough,
it's so. I mean, these are things to consider, because we have a very complex complex situation in terms of the voting, which leads to the state we have, which leads to all the policies and regulations. Yeah. Let's talk about some of those regulations. Our boss went to Parliament on this show.
Even my boss doesn't pay me shit. Where's Kosatu to save us from this exploitation?
Yeah, we're not being paid. We're actually slave labor. That's
exploitation.
By definition.
Where's my rights?
But so Gareth goes with Thibaut Touch to Parliament. I mean, I don't want to be too much of a cynic, but let's be honest. If data was free tomorrow, you know, everything in terms of their business interests probably does a lot better, which is perfectly fine. They're entitled Absolutely. To push their agenda. I don't disagree on the point, though, that data, if it was more accessible to more people, it opens up the whole sort of knowledge of humanity to the entire population.
Yes, but now, what is the one decision made in 94 that screwed everything up concerning broadband?
Yeah, so I'm not going to take your thunder, but I am going to guess that it's got nothing to do with Vodacom going to business.
No.
Exactly.
No. It is with Jay Naidu, who was Minister of Communications at the time, giving the monopoly to Telkom.
Yeah.
Broadband to Telkom.
And then it continued from there, because what happened even in the private sector is that it's so overregulated that it is not a free market.
Well, no, if the state there, there's never free market. But just imagine that monopoly given to Telkom in 1994 to extrapolate the trillions of rands that have not been made due to that monopoly. It's probably incalculable. Just imagine how much money has been lost, how much wealth has never been achieved because one company, a company owned by the state, controls all the broadband in the country.
Yeah. And in terms of the wealth you're talking about, you're not just talking about the wealth Telkom could have generated or a private provider.
People.
So, but not only that, people themselves, individuals having more access to these types of technologies.
And much sooner.
Exactly. Could have generated more wealth.
We could have had a Silicon Valley. The whole country could have been Silicon Valley. Who knows?
Yeah, well, I mean, you just need to look at something like South Korea. I mean, South Korea prioritized internet connectivity. And, you know, today they lead the world, one of the countries that leads the world in terms of the speed, their internet speed. Everyone has access, from the poorest of the poor. I don't have many poor, but...
I do think it's a human right, in a way that I do think once people have access to that type of information, a lot of other social ills falls away. Do you think FISMAS 4 would exist if everyone had high-speed internet data at a cheap price? Do you think it would exist? I doubt it.
It might not, but I probably think that we get to it might not exist in different ways.
Sure.
So I think that it might not, because if you can have, if every 10-year-old has access to the internet over a period, the 8 years before they get to university, I think they get to university a lot more informed a human being.
But would they even attend university? Why would universities want to give courses that don't require physical, that don't require the student to be there? So I think universities would have phased out a lot of like the humanities and even the accounting. They would have stayed with STEM subjects. They would have stayed with a few things.
They might have.
But they wouldn't have had...
I don't think the universities will change. I think the people will change. So, you know, if you look at the United States, for example, Harvard hasn't phased out their humanities degrees.
Sure.
In fact, they've increased them to stupid things. And that goes across the board for all the universities in that country. And I'm sure you could find similar things. I think the universities still haven't figured out quite how to translate the teaching process that happens at a university to your computer screen. And that certainly is, I think, one of the next big things. I agree with you. I don't understand why, for many degrees, why you need to be at the university. Why do you need to be in a physical space?
In a physical space. But an issue with that. You know how many people start the LLB degree at UNISA online?
Yeah.
How many actually pass it all the way to the end? What percentage do you think passes it at the end?
30%?
2%.
Jeez.
That's the problem with online learning. people actually don't focus. People don't actually work.
So if you're, is it a sort of group thing? If you're around other people doing the same thing,
I think
peer pressure, that type of thing?
I do think having a physical connection to something that you're doing in terms of actually being in a lecture and having a type of support system, even though, I mean, involuntarily so. When I was at WITS, my colleagues helped me immensely. We helped each other quite a lot to pass and whatever.
Well, same for me. I wouldn't have passed without my clinical partner.
If you're online by yourself, I think it's difficult to connect with other people in that same way. So, yeah. I mean, that's one aspect.
So,
but anyway,
I mean, we can argue that, and I think it's an interesting area. But bottom line is that you can become a very informed person just by having access to the internet. And then you may think, okay, I don't need university necessarily. And there are plenty of examples.
Well, which universities teach programming?
I think the private
ones. Which one teaches marketing? They do, but how many people actually go to university just to learn marketing? Not many. Many go to...
There is a BCom marketing degree, but...
But many go to specialized schools, right? How many degrees graphics design? How many universities teach that? A few, but how many people actually go to university just to learn about graphic design? I don't think many. So I think if universities could focus on the STEM subjects, and maybe make those free, air quotes... then it could be quite interesting. Then we could have like a hybrid system of private education for everything except STEM subjects.
Well,
that could be interesting.
Well, I think private education is an interesting point, because I think what's going to happen now, I do think our universities are going to be very badly affected.
Yeah.
And I do think the result of that, especially if we carry on down this road towards, inverted commas, free education, is that all that happens is, you know, WITS, UCT, those kinds of universities, UP, from being in the top 500 universities in the world, just drop down the rankings, and basically the degree isn't worth the paper it's written on ultimately 30 years from now. What happens then is people still need university. So people still want to get a engineering degree. So all that's going to happen is private institutions are going to take up that space.
Well,
people are either going to leave the country for that education,
yeah,
or someone, an organization will come into the country, set up a private university. Once again, government standing in the way of that. Medical schools. There are several organizations and companies who have been trying to set up private medical schools for the last 15 to 20 years, constantly blocked by the Department of Health.
Sure. Well, I know of I'm not going to say the name, a trade union has set up their own university, actually, which is, they have centers all over the country, and it's actually an interactive screen. So the lecturer is actually at home or wherever.
They can see you.
And they can see you, and they can write on the screen. It's actually very interactive. And that's just gone live. It's taken them 5 years.
Yeah.
Just to do that.
But in the environment we sit in, it's going to bear fruits. There's no doubt about it, because that is becoming the only alternative.
Sure.
And it's actually going to become the primary way of getting an education, especially if our universities drop a lot in quality.
Not just that, but there's also Monash and Damlin and all, Boston, all those places that also offer that. I don't know if they'll be able to offer STEM subjects, who knows?
Leave it up to the free market, and you never know.
Course,
I think if there's demand, it'll happen.
Indeed.
And at a great cost. And then if you want to talk about not being able to afford education, if you think it's bad that you currently have to pay 30,000 rand or 40,000 rand a year for your engineering degree at WITS or UCT, wait until the private industry are the only people who are giving a quality version of that and charging you 200k a year.
And if you moan, they'll just say,
well, they don't care. They don't have to. We got a little bit of feedback from our last show. We did that Zionism bit.
Yes, you moved on quickly, as you must say. Anyway, moving on to our next topic.
We can be cool like that.
We're not CNN.
So one of the comments was...
Okay, wait. Our last podcast was about the Zionists.
Yeah.
Zionism, rather, with Benji Shulman as our guest. So what is the feedback?
A couple of things. We triggered some of the people on both sides of the debate. But one of the comments was, you weren't very objective. And what do you think about objectivity?
Well, it doesn't exist, especially when humans are involved, right? We never plan to be objective on the show, to be fair. I think we have tried to be objective over Fees Must Fall, because if we are trolling or not, it doesn't really matter. So I think we should actually try to be objective around that. But around the guests in our shows, well, we wanted to talk about Zionism, so we invited a Zionist on. He was, you know, well educated. He knew much more about Israel and Zionism than I ever did.
Yeah.
And the little that I know, it seemed to correspond with what he was saying. So I didn't feel the need to interrupt.
Yeah, there was nothing obvious that was like, oh my God, that's an outright blatant falsity.
Right. I mean, I said kill all the Arabs, not him. And no one has picked a side with me. And I can say it because I'm Arab, so I don't see the issue.
I think, you know, it comes down to this obsession with believing that there's any such thing as objectivity. And maybe there was, or maybe there was more of it before. I think if you look at news networks now, you'll find that they're not objective at all.
No, but they never
were. You know, you've got the Clinton News Network, you know.
CNN.
Yeah, and then you've got Fox, which is clearly pro-Trump. Those are two good international examples.
I mean, you've got Mail and Guardian, which is completely anti-DA. They never say so.
Sure, so we know that. We've got ANN7.
But it's their right to be anti-DA. They should just be honest about it. That's all.
ANN7 who aren't honest about it, but we know because of the back channels that obviously they're pro-government.
I mean, SABC, they don't say either, but it's like obvious that they're anti-DA or pro-government.
So I think, you know, objectivity, a little bit overrated. And also bear in mind that what you do is you get presented with data and facts.
Or arguments.
Or arguments. And then you take that and you collate it together and you take a position.
Right.
And that position, look, I'm not a big fan of fence sitters. So, and most people aren't fence sitters. So I think outwardly they might be to try and not upset people.
Yes.
But you have a position, and humans are innately biased creatures.
Well, they're intuitive creatures, yes. They make their moral reasoning based on intuitions. So I feel a certain intuition when I see Fees Must Fall. Like, I'm a bit not revulsed by it. I'm like, oh, students, entitlement, all these sort of things come out when I think of it. And then it takes me like a minute to calm down.
Yeah, the E word.
And I actually, did I say entitlement?
Yeah.
Well, for education is a damn entitlement. I'm sorry, man. If you come after me for saying entitled students, it's like they're 3% middle class and they want free education. That's entitlement.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so yes, but back to my point. Yeah, we're intuitive creatures. That's been borne out by Jonathan Haidt, who's a psychologist you should read.
Gad Saad, who we had on the show, will tell you all about evolutionary psychology.
No, absolutely. So, I mean, we have no plans to be objective at all, by any means. We just try, I hope, to make good arguments. And sometimes we fail. I accept that. We're not perfect. But our intention is to be logically sound in how we say things. And Benji was perfectly logical and his arguments were good when we heard it. And you're free to disagree, of course.
Yeah.
And you feel free to tell us what we got wrong.
Yeah.
And we're very happy to have someone who is pro-Palestine to come on. We just need to find someone who would do that.
Yeah, so that's just another point to be made, which is if you disagree with something, cool. We have people disagree with us on a daily basis. But saying, oh, you're everything from you're a racist to today I got told how much white privilege I have because I don't agree with Fees Must Fall.
But once again, not an argument.
Not an argument. So none of these things are arguments. So if you disagree, that's perfectly fine. I am not right on everything. And I may see your point and go, okay, you've got a point. I'm going to change my view. But you actually have to present that point. And you actually have to present that argument.
Sure. I had a great discussion with a lady on Twitter who is completely diametrically opposite to me. She actually supports Fees Must Fall.
Yeah.
And she supported the Pretoria girls' hair debacle thing. And I made a tweet that, like, I just don't see, like, racism in telling someone to cut their hair according to the code of conduct. There were a lot of arguments that the code of conduct is outdated, and I fully accept that. And she actually asked for my email address, and she sent me a whole email. She was actually a student there.
Mm.
And she says, throughout her high school career, a lot of not overtly racist, but like, you know, that subjective racism where people say, oh, you speak so well.
Yeah.
And, oh, I know that you're, I know it's difficult to control your hair, but try to do it this way. And you were forbidden to speak in your native language at breaks and things like that.
Yeah.
So she said there was a culture of like this, not overt racism, but like this very, like, how can I explain it? Like, not people who weren't aware of their racism, so to speak. And she sent me this long email about it, and we exchanged emails, and she's completely opposite to me in terms of thinking. Yeah. But we had a great conversation.
And now your head's exploded.
I'm actually thinking of bringing her on as a future guest, because she's actually studies at Wits. But it was really great to have someone reach out and say, no, but the real issue is, this is just the spark.
And this is my argument.
Yeah. But she said the hair thing is just the end of actually like a long period of time where these students actually felt victimized. And then I said, okay, that makes a lot more sense. But no one ever argues that point. They always say, if you don't accept it's racist, then you're the racist. It's like, not an argument, once again.
Yeah.
I keep thinking we speak past each other so many times, and I'm guilty of it. We speak past each other all the time, and we never actually get to the issue at hand.
Well, I'm going to do one of those things again where I say another area of where we didn't get to the issue at hand. It's past, but the Pastor Anderson issue?
Oh, that vile homophobe.
So we also missed, as a nation, we missed the point there.
Well, it was taken out of our control by the state, you know, the state that invites Hamas in here, which and Hamas basically say it killed Jewish people. Yeah. So they're allowed in. So there was a bit of irony there.
And also don't allow the Dalai Lama, which, you know, for all
fuck
these...
the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, but okay. I'm not a big fan of the Dalai Lama, but I don't think he's...
In terms of consistency, it's a problem.
Yeah,
yes.
You know.
I just think we missed a great opportunity here to... I have a feeling Steve Anderson could have been a very good pivot point for the gay community and gay rights groups to come out and actually show their force. Yeah. Show how many there are. Actually give a message, like to South Africans in general, that there's a lot of us who believe this guy is absolute bigot and we'll shout him down. And I think something was missed there by banning him. I think you don't actually deal with the problem because homophobia is terrible.
But I think there's a few things that were missed. Number one is that we made him into a bigger thing than he needed to be.
Right.
So it's not something that was missed, but it's a Streisand effect, really. And then what we really missed is that was about how you can actually show that you are for rights of people, so gay rights, for example. We had the opportunity not to just ban someone, but let him in and then show where you actually stand on the matter.
Right.
And also at the same time, honor the Constitution in the sense of this, we believe in freedom of speech. We believe truly in the ability of people to speak, but in the ability of other people to tell those people what you're saying is wrong or bullshit or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And we miss those opportunities because we overreact and we want to protect people or mollycoddle.
Okay, I don't know about we. I mean, the Melusi Kigaba did it out of his own.
Sure, and it's 2016 also did it.
And yes, of course. And a lot of people actually asked him to do so. So he was capitulated to do so, or he capitulated to that. I just think that there's a dichotomy here between what the Constitution says and people afraid of getting hurt or offended, or that Steve Anderson's sermon could lead to more homophobic violence. That's something that you can't prove if you're not here. Because homophobia is a huge problem in this country in the first place. And I don't think
and how do you get over that violence if you don't confront the issue? So now, cool, we don't have Steve Anderson here.
Yeah,
We've still got homophobia. We've still got corrective rape for lesbians.
Yeah.
We've still got all these issues. We're not really – so you banned the guy from coming in the country. All these problems are still with us. And it's just – I just think we miss the boat. I say absolutely. We, but as a country,
yeah.
In many debates, we miss the boat. We're missing the boat on the fees must fall stuff, as we've discussed. We're missing the boat on the data must fall stuff, because, you know, that's actually got nothing to do with, oh, the companies are ripping us off, which is the sort of attack.
They are sort of. I'm not a big fan of corporations.
But sure, they're ripping us off, but they're ripping us off because they're enabled to rip us off by government regulation.
No, absolutely.
So the issue isn't the companies ripping us off.
No, of course not.
And now with this guy, you know, we ban him, so we've solved the problem. We haven't solved any problem, and we haven't had the discussion.
No, we haven't.
Yeah.
It's a pity that a lot of people who say they're for free speech actually wanted him to be banned as well.
Well, it's not
disconcerting anymore, but it's very sad to me that these people who call themselves liberals say no, they should ban him because he says mean words.
Well, you're not a liberal. You're not a liberal if that's what you feel. It needs to be said. You might be a liberal by American definition.
And often by the same people who defended the spear at all costs, are saying this is an important value of free speech that should remain. And then 3-4 years later, they said no, ban the pastor because of the mean words he says.
Well, I agree. I agree with free speech as long as you don't say something that offends me. Or I disagree with, you know, that's a situation we currently sit with. We have a problem that it would seem that many people, certainly those, especially in the media, believe that free speech is a right, and free speech is enshrined in our constitution. As long as what you're saying is something that doesn't offend their sensibilities.
Right. I mean, a good point is Ivo Wächter wrote a column this Tuesday, and he made a point that all the eco people's predictions have been proven wrong over and over again.
Okay, let's just say that it wasn't just that he made a point. It was that he went and he
did the data.
He found the exact. Yeah, he said this person said this, and they said that by this time, and he found several examples, basically of we're all going to die because of climate change.
Yes.
Okay, so we
won't have any polar bears by 2003.
Sure,
it's 2016, and they're still, yeah.
Sure, we won't have a coastline that looks like a coastline.
And then you have Nahama Brody, who actually does quite good work with Africa Check, who I like.
A great organization.
They do great work, and I think she runs it, or she does some sort of work.
Head of training and research there.
Right, okay. So she does all this work, so she actually knows what data is and how to collect it and things like that. And then she just calls out Ivo as saying, like, what you write will just kill people and will cause untold misery. And I can't believe you have a space to air your ideas like this.
Because you're a climate change denier.
A denialist, yes, whatever that means. I don't know one person who denies that the climate changes. Winter to summer, what, it doesn't exist? Of course it does. Anyway. But here you've got someone who actually knows how to collect, collate, publish research and data.
Mm.
And she's like completely against the fact that Ivo wrote this piece with data in it.
He asked her to refute.
Right.
You know, he said, okay, you know, it's fine, you disagree. Where's your data to say that what I write is wrong or is going to cause the misery of millions of people or something to that effect? And she said, no, I'm not interested in even engaging with you because, you know, basically of who you are. Nothing
right. But my point is, here's someone in the media who knows what data is. I can't express that more thoroughly. She does this for a living.
Yeah. Fact check, Africa Check is literally a data checking company, service.
And it does great work. I quote them all the time. And the head researcher wants to ban Ivo from having a column without looking at his data. Like, it boggles my mind that journalism has come to this space. It boggles my mind to think that these people who do research only want their research or whatever else research to be published, but not Ivo, for example.
Well, you know, it's that issue of that instead of cogent arguments occupying the public discourse, so to speak. We've got ideologies, and everything that everyone's trying to do is just pushing an ideology.
Yes, and we're not innocent of that.
No, well, we push a liberal ideology.
more anarchist.
You push the anarchist.
Liberals are just socialists who don't want to take control of the means of production, in my eyes. But
next time show.
I just think that, the media's fallen. The media must fall. Maybe that should be a hashtag. But I just found it very strange that journalists would say this. Well, I don't find it strange anymore. I'm actually used to it by now. But, like, guys, look at the arguments and objectively assess. Don't not read a piece.
Or just dismiss. I mean, when someone gives you stuff in black and white that is literally in black, you can't refute it. Then either find another data point that is stronger, that will refute it, or at least concede to that point and make another argument or accept the argument. It's very frustrating. I have the same frustration with you in terms of, someone who knows what data is and refuses to engage with it.
With me?
No, not with. I have the same feeling as you.
Oh, the same feeling as me. Okay.
Calm down.
No, but we must disagree on something, I suppose.
People want us to fight. I don't know. What do we disagree on? We've got some questions. Maybe we'll disagree on some of that stuff.
Yeah, let's go through those questions quick.
So we had a couple of questions around the education side of things, obviously related to the stuff that's going on at universities, talking about the differences between free and subsidized education, and also if education is culturally valuable. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure what. There's no such thing as something for free, right? Someone always pays. It's often done through taxes. I know a lot of people quote the Danish system
or the German system.
The Finnish system. The key difference is they've got, and this is important, they've got 90% of the workforce paying taxes.
That's right.
And they got cultural hegemony. Yeah. That is such an important factor that no one ever talks about. All Finnish people are very much alike. And they all want to work, and they all work towards a fairly common goal that the system that has been placed, or that they use, the welfare system, everything like that. Like, a lot of people accept it and are happy with it.
There's buy-in, in other words.
Absolutely. We are a third world country with 11 languages, 50 million people, and different tribes and races and ethnicities. Like, we're not even close to that. And we've got, like, 3 million taxpayers,
about 5 million, but I think 500,000 who pay the majority of the tax.
We can never hope to have a system like that.
Yeah, not in any time in the near or medium term.
No,
it's just not going to happen. And is education culturally valuable? Well, yeah, I think you could make the argument that education is culturally valuable. I suppose it depends where you're coming from. On that, what does it mean to be culturally valuable?
Yeah, I don't understand that question too much.
But I think most people, just in general, I don't know if it links to their culture, do value education.
Yes.
You see this, I've been to enough graduation ceremonies to tell you that parents from every walk of life are very happy to see their children graduate. So it certainly is very culturally valuable. There are, take examples of my own colleagues and friends who become the first doctor in their entire village, and essentially become a folk hero, amongst their whole village, because it is certainly very valuable and very respected. So I do think that education is something to be aspired to. And this is one of the problems we have is in my opinion, is that a lot of the stuff that we should be looked up to kind of give people ambition. Part of humanity is self-actualization. And that's achievement. You get to self-actualization through several ways of achieving many, many different goals in your life personally. One of those things can be education. And I think by tearing these things down, you really are going
to create
misery for people.
Yeah.
It's an outlet that creates a lot of joy. It gives people a lot of happiness. Let's keep money out of it and all of those other things. Just in terms of fulfillment.
I think inherent dignity plays a huge role.
Absolutely. Alright, there's a question about abortion and declining crime. This is the Freakonomics example.
In the first Freakonomics books, basically they made an argument that the decline in the crime rate in America coincided with
Roe versus Wade.
Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion. And their premise is that when people who abort their children are often poorer and single. So a lot of single mothers aborted their children. Mm. And they played on some sort of research to suggest that children born from out of wedlock or from single parent families commit crime the most.
Yeah.
So a lot of these people who had the potential to commit crime in the future were aborted. So there's that correlation. Now, I don't know. I think it's a factor. But there are a lot of other things that happened in the 90s and the 80s, like policing and, a lot of other things could factor into that. Yeah. So
improved economy for some people.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a correlation, but I don't know if it's the major factor.
I think Freakonomics does say that, though. They do say that, this fits in within a greater sort of system.
Yeah.
And this is one potential. If you read the Freakonomics books, they do speak to that. It's never just one thing. But obviously what they're trying to do is they're trying to highlight one specific area. That's like their whole kind of point.
Right. I mean, they just make economics interesting. Because they are actually economists.
Yeah.
Stephen Dubner and Levitt are actually very good economists.
Yeah.
So.
And then lastly, someone wants to know what we think about the US and Russia, and if Russia are really kind of thugs, as the Americans would have us believe, or if the Americans are overplaying it and no, the Russians are actually nice people, and it's the Americans who are, these terrible, globalists and capitalists and all those words that are used.
I think they're both awful.
Yeah.
In every single way. Putin has made everyone poorer in Russia during the course of his tenure,
yeah.
Especially the last 5 years or so. No, he's an awful man in every single way. Yeah. He's like he's like Stalin without the gulags in a way. He loves power. He wants to take what he thinks is rightfully belongs to Russia.
He's trying to reform the Soviet Union.
Yeah, there are some rumors that he's actually the richest man in the world with like $60, $70, $80 billion net worth. No one's been able to prove it, but he's a very rich man. He's friends with all the big guys in Russia. He's like Jacob Zuma, like writ large, right? Yeah, so he's not a great guy.
I think certainly he's not a good guy, and what the Russians do is not necessarily good. For example, in Syria, they are friends with Assad and his regime. It's very complex, certainly you can't say that they are innocent in everything. But what's happened is America and Russia are basically in another Cold War, or they're moving towards it, certainly. And so the stuff you will hear from the Americans is going to be a bit hyperbolic, as it was in the Cold War, about the communists and, the threat that they posed, and with the McCarthy, McCarthyism.
In the Cold War, it was like an actual threat. I don't know if it exists to that extent now.
Yeah, but I think, sometimes some of the rhetoric begets more rhetoric.
Of course. Of course.
And so I think they both actually are pretty bad at the moment. I think you could, if you wanted to take a side, I would probably take the U.S. side, simply because, for example, what Putin's trying to do in terms of expanding into Eastern Europe and reforming the USSR, is dangerous. And that has potentially huge implications. And look, one thing against Donald Trump is that he wants to fiddle with NATO, which is what has kept peace pretty much for these smaller nations or
let's be honest, Donald Trump is an offshoot of Putin in a way. He loves Putin.
Well, it's an ego issue.
He's a strong leader. I can't do the accent. He loves Putin.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy, really great guy. I can't do it.
No, we're both terrible.
We need Gareth in here. So yeah, I mean, they're both awful, and they're both awful. I think that's about the end of that question. Jonathan, how long have we been on?
Long enough.
Okay. All right. Should we call it
that? You want to call it a day?
So I think it's very important to tell the listeners that we have made a conscious decision to be a bit more, thanks for interrupting me, Where's my music?
Your music's coming.
I wanted a rant with the music on.
Yeah,
not a rant. But just listen, we're trying to be a bit more perceptive. We actually met someone who teaches communications. And it was very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And he says, our content is great, but sometimes the tone does put off people that you could reach. So we're not changing anything in terms of content. But I think people who don't like us will be able to listen to us if we're not terribly hyperbolic about what we think, what we say.
Ramon's going to try. I can't make any promises, but I'm doing my best.
Oh, come on. This podcast was a great one, right? We didn't shout. We didn't call anyone idiots.
It was great, which is why everyone who's listening is now going to go on to iTunes and give us a rating and leave a comment.
We are the most rated show in South Africa.
Yeah. There you go. And one of the top podcasts in the country. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @Renegade_report. Also on Facebook. You can like our page. You can find Ramon and myself both on Twitter. Not hard to find. Just search our names. We will catch you on the next Renegade Report. We hope you enjoyed the show. We hope you're enjoying all of the shows. Please tell your friends. Catch you next time. Cheers. CliffCentral.com.